and welcome to Irish Imperial Lives. I'm Kate O'Malley.
And I'm A.B. Philbin-Bowman, and we have an extraordinary bit of detective work for you today. Last season, we gave you an overview of Irish involvement in the British-controlled Caribbean. Today, we're focusing on one individual who starts his career in the Caribbean, but on the outer fringes, as a pirate trader in Dutch-controlled Statia. But he ends it on the South American mainland in what is now Guyana.
And what makes this man so significant is that after a lifetime of trading on the edge of empire, on the edge of legality and indeed the edge of morality, he has amassed one of the largest groups of enslaved people linked to any Irishman for whom records survive. And remarkably, these records only exist because of the Irish influence at the very heart of empire in Westminster.
We don't have his complete life story, but we do have remarkable glimpses into the life, the gluttony, the cruelty and the opulence of Lambert Blair. And they've been put together by our guest today, who is Usher Associate Professor in 19th Century History at Trinity College Dublin, Dr. Kieran O'Neill, who is co-editor of Ireland, Slavery and the Caribbean.
We begin by asking Kieran, what do we know about Lambert Blair's early life in Newry?
We know very little about Lambert's early life, probably born around 1767, about 3 years before his own father died. So we're working backwards from his memorial plate, which is in a church in Twickenham in London, which says he died age 48. And so if we extrapolate back from that, then he was born in 1767. We know that he was born to James Blair, who was a trader in Newry, died in 1770. Newry isn't necessarily the first place you start to think about Irish imperial lives, but actually it had a summit level canal in the early to mid 18th century. It had a port that was actively trading commodities that would be coming from around the world. So it actually was quite an imperialized and globalized space.
Okay, and so he worked then as a teenager alongside his older brother James, and they were merchant sailors, I believe. And the brothers seem to have established a significant and expansive business network. And then they had a third brother who worked with them as well. So it's very much a family business, or it starts off that way.
Yeah, and overseen by his mother and his sisters as well. So what remaining correspondence we have is in Prony in Belfast, and you can see some letters between them. We don't have much, but you can see the sort of family network play out there. So Lambert was probably apprenticed to his older brother, who was already an established trader in the Caribbean, working with some major companies in Liverpool in particular, and then across the Caribbean and into colonial America as well.
And can we surmise it all about the social level of the family in Newry, the mother and the daughters, or do we have any idea at all?
Middle-class merchants is probably what you're looking at. So you're not looking at a major house. It isn't comparable to a major trading company in Liverpool. It's a small trading house because it doesn't make much of an impact in its own right. It seems that they derive most of their importance and their money from the Liverpool houses that they were connected into. So minor merchant family.
Okay.
And we've looked a little bit at the Caribbean in other episodes of this series, and it seems to be a very important trading hub. Obviously, we know there are very profitable British plantations there, often relying on enslaved people to do the labour. But there are also significant trading links. I mean, you know, the Americans during the War of Independence and afterwards are sourcing a lot of stuff from the Caribbean. And also there's trade going on. We came across trade being done with the Spanish Empire, and the Dutch are also at play here. So is there a sense here of the family? Are they British doing the trade of the empire, or are they kind of out there for themselves as freebooting entrepreneurs?
Are they on the make, Kieran?
They are on the make. So one of the reasons I was really interested in them is that they're a really good proxy for understanding the Irish position in empire. So Irish traders, like Irish mercenary military figures, are willing to trade or fight under more or less any flag in the Caribbean. It's kind of what marks Irish out as somewhat exceptional within European colonialism of the period. Because the Irish are presumed disloyal and sometimes of uncertain origin, which they like to play around with, trading and fighting under the French flag, under the Dutch, for the Danish, for the British, there's a huge amount of movement and a huge amount of ambiguity, and most Irish traders use that in their favour. So Lambert's a really good example of that. He's quite happy to trade against British interests. He's quite happy to turn up and pretend to be a good British citizen in Berbice, Guyana, where he ends up eventually. In between, he's happy to be essentially a pirate trader in a Dutch free colony in St. Eustatius. So he pops up everywhere.
And when you say a pirate trader, like, what does that entail? Is he himself at sea raiding trade ships, or is he just receiving stolen goods from other pirates? Do we know?
And before we go on as well, he's a teenager. When this is all happening and he's working with his brothers, he's a young teenager, right?
The first time Lambert really appears in the historical record is when he gives evidence to a commission that's investigating the invasion of St. Eustatius, which is this tiny little rock right beside St. Kitts, which is a slightly bigger, slightly bigger operation next door, and so on. So yeah, it's a really tiny little island, and he's there as a 14-year-old trader. Remarkable when you think about it, like
incredible.
A teenager wouldn't even be doing his junior cert now. But there he is. He's not a trader in the sense that he's not attacking ships, and most pirates aren't doing that. But what he's doing is he's pirating or selling without any tariffs or taxes. Goods from his little warehouse, which is on a beach in this tiny little island at St. Eustatius, Statia they call it. Basically, there's a mile long a beach there, and it's full of free trade warehouses, and Lambert's one of the bigger ones.
So this raid that you referred to, this is the one in 1781. It's led by British Admiral George Rodney, and he insists he's raiding Statia to try and help disrupt the Dutch traders from supplying revolutionary America. But his critics point out that Rodney has quite substantial debts, and they think he's just out to enrich himself and clear those debts. Hence, there is a controversy and a parliamentary investigation, and thus we have an inventory of all the things Lambert Blair was trading at the time.
Absolutely. There's a full inventory given to him by the commission that investigates Rodney's attack on St. Eustatius, 1781. So we know exactly what he was trading. We know exactly what was in his warehouse. And it was kind of like a bit of anything. It's like a little department store. He would sell you linen, he'd sell you rum, tobacco, anything he had. And there was no tax being paid. And this was why the British were keen to attack that little colony.
We have a lovely quote here from a chapter that you've written about the goods that were listed from his warehouse. He had women's French heels and shoes, handkerchiefs, medicine, ivory-handled knives and Irish linen, also food, butter, beef, mutton, cider and gin, with tobacco and muskets for good measure. So really, this is quite the department store.
Absolutely. And you also get some sense that, yeah, you can park a 14-year-old on this island and they're trading, you know, as a full adult, as a full trader.
It's worth pointing out that one of the effects of this trade on these small Dutch islands is tariff-free tea had been coming into the Americans. And that's when they kind of go, well, why are we paying all this excessive East
Topical.
India Company imposed, you know, tax? Let's chuck this in the Boston Harbor because they know they can get their tea. We had a fantastic story in one of our previous episodes about John Barry helping to smuggle gunpowder from the Caribbean up, which was so vital to the American war effort. And he got about two thirds of it off, and the remaining third is left on board. And he comes up with a makeshift fuse on the spot. And just as he flees, the British arrive and the whole thing blows up. So it's a really vital trading ground. You can see why the British raid it. And yet the extraordinary thing is that Lambert Blair, his way of getting revenge, he doesn't just petition Parliament. He leaks the details to Edmund Burke to go, listen, make us think about this in Parliament. This is honest British traders like myself. We're just caught up in the middle here. How are we supposed to make a living?
Absolutely. No, and he's quite a little chancer. So he sort of formally requests that the British would compensate him for shutting down his little department store on the beach in Statia. He doesn't get compensated. But what you learn from the compensation claim is that £800 worth of his 4,000 goods, they were owned by a fella in Liverpool, you know, another £400 interest in some of his other goods. You begin to see how the system works and what they're selling and reselling.
And how does that go down in Parliament?
Well, I mean, there's not a lot of sympathy. Rodney's reputation is greatly enhanced by a battle in the following year, the Battle of the Saints. So that rehabilitates his reputation. It was really quite scandalous, this attack on St. Eustatius, because it was seen to be illegal and unwarranted by some in the court of public opinion. It sort of also reveals Burke both-siding imperialism and colonialism. And that's an interesting one because Burke has a lot of fans right down to the present. But, you know, when you look at Burke's willingness to overlook, in particular, the trade of enslaved people and the profits that derive from that trade in the Caribbean versus his reputation for being quite a critic of empire elsewhere, you begin to see that even, you know, Burke's attitude to empire is much more complex than we usually suggest.
And is there a sense that that's the Irish link? Here's somebody, a well-respected member of parliament from Ireland, and I can leak him the information and use that network. On the one hand, he's out at the absolute frontier trading with whoever. And at the same time, he's like, but I can use parliament, my status as a British citizen, to get compensation here.
Yeah, all the merchants are savvy about that. So they're willing to use whatever capital they have, you know, and so the Blairs would have been advised by some of the bigger houses in both New York and in Liverpool and so on. So they would have been quite conscious to say, well, use whatever contacts you have.
the impression I'm getting from the way you're describing him is almost like that guy you'll find in the middle of a war zone or a frontier town who you wouldn't trust him as far as you could throw him, no moral compass, but for the right price, he will get you whatever you want, whether it's women's shoes or gunpowder or indeed enslaved people. I don't think he's responsible for bringing enslaved people over himself, but once they're in the Caribbean, he's quite happy to get involved in that.
Yeah, so Lambert Blair is a reseller. He doesn't seem to have been involved in the sourcing of enslaved people from West Africa, but he seems to be very happy to acquire and then resell them when they're in the Caribbean or down in South America. And that's what he makes the bulk of his money on. I mean, by the time the 1830s roll around, Lambert's holdings have 1,598 slaves. It's an extraordinary number by any standards. If you think about contemporary American figures like Thomas Jefferson had in the low hundreds. So someone like Lambert Blair has enormous human capital at his disposal, and you don't acquire 1,598 slaves without an excessive amount of trading. So in between the gaps of what we know of his life, we know that he accumulated that vast fortune through opportunistic trading between different empires at different moments. And we can reconstruct some of that, but not all of it.
So would enslaved people have passed through Statia at this time?
Yeah, although it seems that St. Kitts was a more active market. Oh. So Statia was more about goods, as far as we can
reconstruct. So he's kind of going up in the rung then in terms of and market value. Presumably.
Statia is his start and he's still trading with his older brothers. It's still the two brothers trading under their own name.
And then the brother dies?
Brother dies and then Lambert trades on his own name from that point onwards. Okay. It's not exactly clear when, but in the mid-1780s seems like a good guess.
Okay, so we're then moving from St. Kitts to Barbies, which is now in present-day Guyana, controlled alternately at this time. You can maybe throw a bit of light on this first, Ciarán, by the English and the Dutch. So we're in the mid-1790s. And this is at the forefront of British extension of empire. So we're now on the mainland of South America. So what's happening in here and what brings them to Barbies?
Yeah, so the Dutch had been in that particular region, Barbies and Demerara.
Which is the sugar, of course.
Yes, which is where our sugar still comes. You still see it on your brown sugar package. So Demerara, Essequibo, and then you have Barbies. As you look at South America, Barbies is the colony to the furthest left. So there had been a Dutch colony for well over 100 years in this particular region. The Dutch were alleged by the British to have been quite lazy or somewhat indolent colonizers of that space. It was thought by the British that there was more money to be made out of Barbies.
Okay.
And so that's one of the reasons why they turn up in the 1790s while everything's in tumult again and there's colonies trading hands between the French and the British all over the place. They turn their attention to Barbies. And between 1796 and 1800, the colony sort of changes hands a number of times. It's very difficult to reconstruct who exactly is in control of it. And that's around the time Lambert Blair seems to be able to invest heavily into Barbies himself. So he ends up with 20 lots out of an available 80. Basically, he's in charge of a quarter of the entire colony. 20,000 acres.
Wow.
And all this despite the fact that the Dutch governor of Barbies hasn't stayed on.
Yeah.
And they do not get on.
And he hates Blair.
Yes.
Yeah, and the feeling seems to be mutual.
I'll pull the quote in because I think it's just so telling. Governor Abraham Van Battenberg, after whom I'm not named, Kate. this is his quotation. The zeal of Mr. Blair for the general good had never yet been proved on any occasion. But the contrary was often complained of. And the steps he had now taken proceeded from a cowardly wish to avenge himself. And nobody would deny that when that man was actuated by motives of interest, the meanness of his character was fully displayed, while his pompous pride was likewise conspicuous when he exhibited his ridiculous vanity. So, not exactly the best mates.
Not pals, no. So Blair amasses enormous power and money in the colony. And like I say, he's building up his enslaved population up to the 1598 that we know it gets to when it transfers to his nephew and he dies. So he has enormous capital and he's also, and this was one of the things that really drew me to him in the first place, there are these very descriptive passages of how he's spending his money by George Pinkard, who's this sort of travelling Scots tourist through the colony in the very early 19th century, and he's recording his impressions and he's writing up what it's like to meet Blair in his house. And this is where you begin to see what Blair is like in his peak years, right? So with all the money in the world and not much to spend it on except what's around him. So we begin to see him importing huge amounts of prestige British foods and drinks and spending them, you know, lavishly entertaining his guests. There's a sort of an orgy of excess. And
I'm actually going to read a quote from Pinkard right now and a quick apology in advance to any Scottish listeners who may be joining us. We were rowed across the mouth of the river by eight of the finest slaves of the estate, who pulled us on with surprising speed. We had a pleasant ride about a mile and a half through fields of cotton and of plantains, the negroes running at the horse's side according to the custom of the country, as fast as we chose to ride. Mr. Blair is one of the most opulent planters in these colonies, and not disliking the good things of life himself, he's assembled them at his place of residence, in sufficient supply to enable him to treat his friends with the most sumptuous liberality. He is generous and social, and the riches of his table are disposed with all the bounty of his nature. Instead of a plain cottage just rising from the wild woods of an infant settlement, we might have fancied ourselves feasting in one of the hospitable mansions of Old England, nay, in some chartered hall, even of voluptuous London itself.
Yes, yeah, so that was Dr. George Pinkard, apparently Scottish. But I mean, I think the important thing to take from this is his very matter-of-fact description of the enslavement of people in that passage. And that the fact that it's so coarsely accompanied by sumptuous meals and excessive drinking. And this is the type of thing that abolitionists associated with the corrupting influences of slavery. And it's on clear display here.
What I think is so jarring in a way is that it's being celebrated almost defiantly at a time when there is now a substantial body of criticism,
yeah,
which he must know about.
It's
he must
two fingers, for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's like, well, you know, you're critical of this, but look at the opulence. Look at the amazing food on display. We could be in voluptuous London. This is the best of the best, the finest of the fine, all made possible by the violence inflicted on these enslaved peoples.
It really brings to mind that great quote that's in there from Maria Nugent, who describes the men of the Caribbean, the planters of the Caribbean, as men who ate like cormorants and drank like porpoises, which is this wow. great line that she had.
Yeah.
And so I kind of became obsessed with the appetites of Lambert Blair when I was researching him, just the extent to which the excess was sort of, you know, orgiastic and disgusting.
And again, that presumably feeds into some of the, I won't call it propaganda, but certainly the message that those who are opposed to the slave trade want to portray. They want to portray these disgusting, revolting, overly pampered guys out in the Caribbean who are wasting huge amounts of human capital and blood and living fantastic lives high on the hog while those beneath them suffer, which is probably not inaccurate.
No, it's totally accurate. I mean, Lambert Blair would be an absolute poster boy for the abolitionist movement. You know, yeah. I mean, this is a kind of a classic story of somebody who has lost the run of themselves and is treating those who are beneath him in this horrible hierarchy of a colony that depends on enslaved labour appallingly. You can see how Pinkard's description of him really plays into that. I mean, Pinkard, it seems to me, is a fan of Blair, but unintentionally he may have been providing ammunition.
I love this quote. So we have a quote from George Pinkard from this travel journal. I don't know, would it make Instagram today? Probably, I don't know. But here we go. The dinner table exhibited a happy combination of English taste and Irish hospitality. At no other house in the colony were such entertainments given. To crown the feast, complete course of sweets consisting of no less than 24 dishes, nor were the fluids of the banquet less amply administered. Hock, claret, Madeira and port wines were all in liberal use. We also had seltzer and spa water, likewise bottled small beer, ale and porter with brandy, rum, Hollands, Noyau and other liquors, all in supply sufficient for a Lord Mayor's feast. So that's a fair amount of booze to top off the food at the end of this table. Do you get a sense from Pickard's reports, is he doing this to impress him or is this actually par for the course?
I mean, I'm sure he's ramping it up when he has visitors from afar because he wants to impress them. I suppose what's galling is when you read up on the colony of Berbice and you understand the environment that this excess is happening in. It sounds like a great party, right? You think, wow, that would have been amazing. But at the same time, you know, between 30 and 50% of the enslaved that were being imported into this absolutely brutal colony were dying within 2 years of arriving, right? So there's this constant turnover, just mass death of the enslaved who are out there working in stagnant water because the topography of Berbice is such that you have a huge amount of disease and decay for these vulnerable populations that are coming in ill health. Anyway, they're working in stagnant water, which means they're getting all the diseases of the colony, which they're not prepared for. And they're just dying in vast numbers.
And then just to top off his ridiculous vanity, this whole area that he captured was called Blairmont after his good self.
I mean, Irish planters do this everywhere. They do it in the American colonies. They do it all over the Caribbean.
In Jamaica, Brownstown.
Yeah, plantations named Belfast, plantations named Dublin. So there's a sort of a claiming of territory there again, which we're not used to thinking about from an Irish point of view.
Were they more excessive, almost to prove a point?
I mean, they were certainly aware of the criticism, which by the early 19th century was deafening. from the abolitionists. It hadn't been 50 years previously, but by the 1800s, 1810s, it was a very strong critique. While these quotes were taking place, while these parties were taking place, everybody involved understood that they were being criticised.
Yeah.
This brings us very neatly to our final source on Lambert Blair, which is the parliamentary record on what he and other owners of enslaved peoples are paid. And there's an extraordinary coincidence here, because one of the main beneficiaries of all of this is James Blair, his nephew, who uses the family wealth to purchase a seat in Parliament through what was called at the time a rotten borough. These are these kind of very old seats that they have almost no voters left, so you can bribe whoever is left. So he purchases this rotten borough of Saltash, and I don't think he speaks very often. I think he's about two speeches in his whole parliamentary career. But the whole point for him of being in Westminster is that he wants to vote to protect the interests of slave owners. And by this amazing coincidence, 25 years earlier, that same rotten borough of Saltash was occupied by another Irishman, the guy we spoke about in our last episode, Richard Wellesley, the Earl of Mornington, who went on to conquer half of India. And despite his many failings, and you can hear all about them in the previous episode, Richard Wellesley was a lifelong, very principled, very vocal opponent of the slave trade. So you have this extraordinary turnaround that in the 1790s, Saltash is represented by an Irishman who thinks we need to abolish the slave trade immediately and we can't wait a few years, it has to be done now. And yet by 1818, it's being occupied by a different Irishman who thinks, no, we should keep the slave trade as long as we possibly can. We're actually making quite a lot of money out of it. So can you tell us a little bit more about the inheritance which Lambert Blair passes on to his nephew James and the rest of the family?
Yeah, so it's the first visibility you have of how many enslaved people he had, really, because the figures for Berbice are kind of sketchy. So we see that James, his nephew, who inherits the plantations in Berbice and any other property Lambert had, he is compensated to the tune of £83,000 for 1,598 slaves across three different plantations. The compensation records are hugely important to any historian of, particularly slavery within the British Empire.
Could you tell us just a little bit about those records, Ciarán? Because our listeners can look that up and have a look at some of these records online themselves. It's a wonderful resource.
Yeah, it's an amazing kind of public humanities project out of University College London. So it's called Legacies of British Slave Ownership. And what it does is it details an impartial snapshot of all of the people who were compensated for a loss of income when the British abolished slavery. So the compensation is given over in the 1830s after a longish process of getting to that point. First of all, banning the transatlantic slave trade in 1808, earlier in the century, and then gradually coming up to the compensation. The reason we know or have those records is because Daniel O'Connell objected in Parliament to their being sealed, which means there's a visibility to it.
It's a great Irish link there as well.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it shows the breadth of public opinion on the matter.
I mean, this is freedom of information long before the term
it's an
existed.
FOI, it's absolutely.
We're not paying off these guys unless we know who we're paying off and what they're getting paid for.
It is an FOI. That's a really good way of putting it.
And what most people don't realise is that the taxpayer in Britain was paying off this debt right up until 2015. 2015 was when the last payment was made over. That's how long it took.
Sorry,
this amount of
they
money.
Were paying these until 2015?
Yeah.
They were just, what it was like, we'll pay you 80% of the value of these people now and we'll write down the rest over like a 100-year...
Essentially, yeah. So the last payment off the books was...
Who? Really give recent. Us names.
No, I don't know. I don't know exactly the mechanism, but yeah.
You'd have to think if you were being on that list being published today or if that was being FOI, you'd kind of think, maybe I'll give that money back or give it to a good cause. Because
there are discussions about that, I'm sure.
And some people have put their neck above the parapet and said, look, we owe something back and here it is.
Well,
very few.
It's worth remembering the scale of reparations to the slave owners whenever the reparations to the former enslaved are discussed, I think.
Exactly.
That's a really crucial point.
Absolutely.
And one that people like Hilary Beckles and Caracom make much more eloquently than I do. But something like that, the fact that we're generationally paying off that debt to people who enslaved others, well, it shows you how power works and how it works up to the present. And it also shows you how we've continued to value lives above others right down to the present.
Do we know how Lambert Blair dies and how his legacy is passed on? Because there's a will and there's a detail, I think, that caught your eye, Kate.
Oh, gosh, yes. I love that you filled in for the record the name of his goddaughter, who is Isabella Jessie Mackenzie, because he said in the will, and it's quoted, "My goddaughter, whose name he could not recollect for the purposes of his will." I'm wondering if that's because of the copious amounts of drink he had acquired after his time in Burmese.
But he leaves or something, I suppose it's that.
So we don't know the exact cause of death, actually. We can only surmise. But he dies young. Not totally uncommon for planters. They tended to have a bigger level of burnout than their equivalents back in England. That partly got to do with climate, partly got to do with lifestyle, as we've seen from the quotes. His was quite extreme anyway. We have very little evidence of how he looked. We have one miniature portrait, which I use in the piece I write in him.
I don't want to defend him, given all the things we've learned about him, but he, I guess, would make the case that he took all the risk moving out to this very uncertain part of the world as a teenager. I'm sure took his life in his hands many times when trading with all kinds of unsavory characters, pirates, etc. And he would see it as having started out from a pretty modest, as you say, middle-class merchant family in Newry, that actually his nephew goes on to become an MP based on this wealth. I mean, do the Blairs go up in the world of the family? Do they become a sort of part of the establishment, or is it a flash in the pan and then they retreat back into obscurity?
Yeah, they really retreat back into obscurity. So there's no great sort of House of Blair that builds up from these two. Lambert's fortune derived to John McCammon, who was another nephew, and James Blair. James Blair gets the money, and James Blair dies and his money goes into the Stopford Green dynasty. So in a sense, it doesn't really work out for the Blairs. The Blairs back in Newry continue to trade on beyond Lambert's lifetime, but they don't become a sort of a major Ulster dynasty either. And that sometimes happens. You know, it can only take two generations to lose a fortune, and these fortunes were, you know, easily gotten, easily lost.
Thanks so much to our guest today, Dr. Ciarán O'Neill, who's Usher Associate Professor in 19th Century History at Trinity College Dublin. I really need to recommend for our listeners today Ireland, Slavery and the Caribbean, which was edited by Fionnuala O'Kane and our guest Ciarán O'Neill today. It really gives a fantastic background to some of the topics we covered in today's episode.
And just chatting to Ciarán there, he told us that some of his students have been listening to the series. He teaches a course on Ireland and Empire. So if it's something you're fascinated in and you want to study it, that course is running. Our show has actually become not required reading, but encouraged listening. So huge thanks for that. And a big shout out to all of his students who are studying that subject. If any of them encounter a brilliant life and want to pitch it to us, or indeed if you do, you can get us at irishimperiallives@rte.ie.
Also, thanks to all of those who are responsible for helping us get the series on the air, to Jack Murphy, Elizabeth Larrigy, Nigel Wheatley and Sally Curran. And also our theme music is from composer Bill Whelan's Belfast Linen and Lace.
You can listen back to this episode or any of our previous ones, including several covering the Caribbean, all the way back in episode 1. We looked at the Earl of Inchiquin, who ended his career in Jamaica. We also did an episode called The Irish of the Caribbean. And there's even a bonus episode on a single Irish ancestors of Kamala Harris. All of these and our previous episodes available on the RTE website or wherever you podcast. Just search Irish Imperial Lives.